Hello and welcome back to another night of Luceris Telehealth Radio. I'm Michelle Hager, managing partner of Luceris, and our next guest is no stranger to the show, Kyle Zebley. He's the ATA Senior Vice President for Public Policy, as well as the Executive Director for ATA Action, which is a 501c6 trade organization that is the advocacy arm of ATA. Prior to joining ATA, Kyle was the Chief of Staff of Global Affairs with the Department of Health and Human Services. So a perfect person for us to talk telehealth with and government affairs. Thanks for joining the show tonight, Kyle.
Great to be back. Thanks so much for having me, Michelle.
It's always great to have you. You always have great information to share with us and our listeners. As you know, there are folks that are listening to this live and will be sort of, driving back and forth from their individual activities they might be doing in the Boston area here. And we always talk about telehealth and healthcare. But tell folks and our listeners that may be, wondering what work does ATA do? What does ATA Action do? And how has public policy and regulation changed what you do on a daily basis?
Well, thank you so much for that, Michelle. So the ATA, the American Telemedicine Association, has been around for 30 years. We're celebrating our 30th anniversary this year. And what we're
Congratulations.
trying to do is really simple, is try to make sure that we're deploying technology in healthcare to meet the needs of patients where and when they need care. And at the end of the day, in our mind, we are very strongly of the belief that telehealth and remote care and virtual care technologies are part and parcel with healthcare. That's not something separate and apart. We envision a world where those technologies are fully integrated at every step along the way of a patient journey in the healthcare system. I will also just note that we, of course, have a huge part of our work that is based in the public policy space, and that's where I lead on behalf of the ATA. And in that area, it's really about educating folks about what that better world would look like if we were able to get the federal and state laws and rules and regulations that would facilitate the appropriate deployment of healthcare technology from our perspective. And then, as you noted, I lead ATA Action as executive director, and that's the advocacy arm of the ATA. That's where we do the direct lobbying and other work to make sure that state policymakers or federal policymakers are really understanding our perspective on a given issue that they are considering and will potentially act upon. The biggest area that we've worked on over the last 3 years was making sure that telehealth was responding to the major crisis facing our nation, the COVID-19 crisis, that telehealth really helped, keep people at home, keep people safe, keep people receiving clinically appropriate care when it was appropriate. And what happened early in the pandemic were many of those actions taken by the federal government and by the state government were temporary in nature. And so the biggest goal for us over these last 3 years was to take all these positive advancements for telehealth in public policy and make them permanent. At the state level, we've been pretty darn successful at that. And at the federal level, we've been able to create a world where we have the extensions that I think will get us to the road to permanency in the long run, but I'm sure we'll get into the ins and outs of that in a little bit. So I hope that's a good overview and response to your question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important for people to know. I often when I speak to folks, and I'm sure you do, Kyle, about advocacy, they don't think that they have the ability to talk directly to their legislators, and that maybe their value around that isn't as valuable as someone else's. And I think that it's important to know everyone's story is important for them to understand. I know in my state of South Carolina, my representative actually was an insurance salesman, a car insurance salesman before he became our district representative. And he does not understand healthcare. And so it's important that I spend some time and talk with him about telehealth and the stories and how that affects me personally. and also the people that I work with and work around. Do you often talk to folks about how to best advocate on in this space, and what would be your advice?
Well, it's a fantastic point, Michelle, and it really is so true that it's important for everyday Americans from all walks of life to communicate to their elected officials, be they federal elected officials like your member of Congress or member of the Senate from your state, or state elected officials, statewide elected officials, gubernatorial offices, and state legislators. It's so important for the public to be engaged and to lift up their voices when an issue is important to them. Obviously, telehealth is a really popular issue. It really crosses across our support. It goes across from Republicans to Democrats and independents.
Yeah,
from rural Americans. Yeah, rural Americans, urban Americans, suburban Americans, everybody's supportive of it and see clear benefit from having access to it. But we shouldn't take this broad popularity, this bipartisan support for granted. We've got to make sure that elected officials and policymakers in key roles are hearing from everyday Americans about the importance of telehealth in their life, the importance of telehealth for their loved ones, and their desire to make sure that the advancements that we've made over these last few years don't slide backwards, or that regressive policies that limit the full potential of telehealth are put in place at any given time. You got folks like me out there on the front lines all the time. And obviously there's a great deal of value in having an association like the ATA and ATA Action fighting on behalf of our members, fighting for the public to make sure they have that access to care. But having worked in government myself, having worked in a congressional office, there's a real attention paid to the voices of constituents. And when a letter comes in, when a phone call or an email comes into the office, there's an understanding that individual that had reached out really is emblematic of many, many times just that one individual in terms of the views and the perspectives of constituents. And so it really does have a big impact. So folks need to get.
Yes, your voice does matter. Your voice does matter. So talk a little bit about Linda Branigan was on the show, was our first guest, and we talked about how provider licensure agreements across state lines is affecting the care that they can provide at UCSF and how that is affecting them being able to, you know, really be able to care for patients when they are coming from other states and having a continuity of care. Talk about the provider licensure space, what the future holds there, and what ATA and ATA Action, what your thoughts are on that, and what you may be doing behind the scenes.
Well, it's one of our most important issues, and it's something that just about every member of the ATA and ATA Action has as a high priority, because if you think about what's technologically possible, how to take full advantage of virtual care technology, that obviously would include the ability to deliver care across the country to any American, regardless of where they're physically located, regardless of what state they're located in. For a lot of complicated reasons, in this country, we have a very federalized system, and over more than a century of built up precedent, the ability to license individuals to practice medicine or practice another healthcare profession, that licensing is done at the state level. And you are, as a licensed medical professional, bound to adhere to the laws of the state in which the patient is located. So here we have this kind of inevitable tension. The technology and the ability to deliver the care really doesn't need to recognize state borders. The technology is there to really break down those barriers to interstate care. However, the state governments obviously have a vested interest to maintain control over who gets to deliver the care in the state where the patient's located. One of the ways to break down those barriers from our perspective is through states adopting the various licensure compacts that are out there, such as the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact or the Nurses Compact. And that allows for states to come together and say, we're going to make it easier for providers outside of our state's borders to deliver care to patients in our state, because we understand that that'll increase patient choice. We understand that there's still layers of accountability in place for bad actors. We understand that you can deliver that care in a clinically appropriate way that adheres to the laws of the state. So that's why we're so supportive of compacts. And we do think there's a role for the federal government that could play here in incentivizing states to adopt compacts or registration models that are ideally reciprocal in nature, so that hopefully we can get to a place in time in the not too distant future where these protectionist measures that keep out of state licensed medical professionals out of delivering care to patients in state, that those barriers come tumbling down and never reemerge again.
Yeah, certainly. I think those of us that are in healthcare all the time, we understand like pharmacists have these reciprocity laws. That's a tongue twister this morning. Certainly the nursing compact is pretty prolific across the country, but it's actually the physician, the provider, compacts and the medical compacts that are actually, kind of laggards in this space. And I think most listeners wouldn't know that if you are actually on vacation in another state, your provider is in, say, Massachusetts, and you vacation in Florida, technically they're not supposed to provide you any care because they may not be licensed in the state in which you are located, as you mentioned. So technology kind of breaks those barriers down.
That's right. And that's actually why, in addition to the licensure flexibility models I mentioned, the compacts and the registration model, there also is a real movement afoot that would allow for, at minimum, common sense exceptions to strict enforcement of licensure. And this has been endorsed by, esteemed groups such as the Uniform Law Commission, and also by the Federation of State Medical Boards, which represents the various licensing boards across the country. So the fact that these esteemed groups have endorsed it, I think, along with the ATA and many other groups, I think will hopefully build up a sense of momentum. And what are those exceptions to strict enforcement of licensure? Obviously, that would include the ability to receive care as a patient while you're on vacation, so that a provider does not need to worry about it. So that continuity of care is maintained for the patient when they're on vacation, when they're away at school, for our college students, when you're on work travel, also care, for instance, such as second opinion consultations, where you're going to ask another medical professional whether or not a diagnosis makes sense or a round of treatment makes sense, and also for follow-up care. For instances where, you might travel across state lines to another state for a particularly delicate surgery or treatment, folks that travel across the country to the Cleveland Clinic or the Mayo Clinic, these types of esteemed institutions, John Hopkins, many others, Boston has no shortage of folks that travel into town in order to get treatment. The idea then would be that you can continue to receive, follow-up care as needed from your team of medical professionals that had treated you in that other state. And so there's a real sense of momentum around those common sense exceptions. And so hopefully more and more states will adopt model laws or their own unique laws that allow for those kinds of exceptions.
Yeah, good points. I definitely am in furious agreement with you there. Hopefully we'll see some change around that. Let's talk a little bit about reimbursement and some of the other challenges that exist within telehealth. I think it may not be widely known, but there's some initiatives around on the payer space to pay at less than parity, meaning less than a face-to-face visit, at some percentage, whatever that might be, 80, 90, some odd percentage of a full face-to-face visit. Arguments around that are, well, you don't have to pay for tongue depressors and cotton balls. And, you know, of course, we would argue, well, yeah, you have to pay for computers and microphones and video cameras, which are a little bit more expensive. But that's probably a bigger argument. But we have made incremental change in reimbursement. We have seen CMS and other organizations come together recently to say, okay, we need to look at how we are going to reimburse telehealth. And we've had services like remote patient monitoring, like remote therapeutic monitoring, that have codes that have, you know, chargeable codes around telehealth. Yet because of the way that they've been created, in my opinion, that's arguable that they have had less than the volume that we, I think, would have anticipated in terms of usage. Yet we know this is a good service to provide to patients. A good example is patients that are, you know, diabetic and they can be remote monitored, or patients that have CHF and they need to have a scale to make sure they haven't gained any water weight, which is an indication of a potential reemergence of their cardiac issue. And we could go on and on, lots of clinical reasons why you would want to do remote patient monitoring or remote therapeutic monitoring. When you think about that and the issues around reimbursement and the barriers around that, what is ATA and ATA Action? What are their positions around that? And what is CMS and HHS in your mind's eye going forward, thinking about for the future?
It's a great question. A few things to reflect on, Michelle. One is, while we certainly seek coverage parity at the ATA, we are a big tent membership, and we are not out there really fighting for payment parity per se, though lots of organizations are, and there's lots of support out there. And so by no means do we dismiss it, and by no means do we oppose it. But we've got a big tent membership, and so we want to make sure all payers, be they commercial payers or public payers like Medicare or Medicaid, want to make sure they're covering it. And obviously, there has to be a level of fair payment that we're very supportive of, that will make sure that these are options available for patients, which means that there must be a level of reimbursement adequate enough to continue to offer those services. And so there could be some complications about, you know, some differences of opinion about payers paying at different rates than in-person care. But so long as there's enough reimbursement present in order to make sure that that patients and Americans can take advantage of the telehealth services that are being covered by their payer, that's the big thing for us. Also, I would just also say, before responding to your exact question about remote monitoring and Medicare, that if you don't take care of some of these legislative and regulatory hurdles to the use and deployment of telehealth technology, if you don't handle those barriers, you'll never even get to questions of reimbursement to begin with. So if you have geographic originating site restrictions, if you slice and dice which technology and modalities can be deployed, and slice and dice which services and providers are able to offer those modalities in tech, if you don't take care of those problems, you'll never get to the question of reimbursement. And so sometimes it's first things first, though obviously in our healthcare system, payment is going to always be critical. To this direct question of remote monitoring, you know, to include remote physiologic monitoring and remote therapeutic monitoring as present in the Medicare program, it's really important to appreciate the gains that we've achieved over the last half decade. We have a variety of codes that are reimbursable to providers for the use of remote monitoring technology in Medicare, and that was hardly a given based on where we were for years prior to them finally accepting those codes. And so that was a long time coming. And the fact that Medicare began reimbursing, like I said, about a half decade ago, a little longer, for remote physiologic monitoring, and then expanded a couple years back into remote therapeutic monitoring, is an advancement that's no small thing. We do quibble with how Medicare might reimburse for some of these services and some of the restrictions they put in place. Really notably, for instance, the Medicare program requires 16 days of data in a month in order to be reimbursable. And as you mentioned, there's a whole host of use cases for diabetic care and therapeutic care and primary care and other conditions. And we list them, usually it's about a half a page of one of our letters in response to the annual physician fee schedule that Medicare puts out. There are lots of use cases that would be totally clinically appropriate without reaching that very high threshold. And so those are the types of barriers that we think that Medicare should reconsider. But let's not take for granted the fact that we've had this advancement. And obviously, let's continue to push to make sure that there's no diminishment of reimbursement and there's a better acceptance of more clinical use cases that would allow for reimbursement. There was a major effort that I won't get into the ins and out of at the end of February that looked like Medicare advisory contractors were going to be perhaps diminishing payment or creating regional variability that could have diminished payment for remote monitoring technology. But having heard from lots of experts about all the wonderful uses of remote monitoring, the MACs, as they're called, backed off that. And that was because of the advocacy that we talked about earlier. It was from committed Americans that were weighing in to make sure that there was no slackening in the offering of remote monitoring technology by Medicare. And so that was a successful area of engagement, but there's obviously more to do.
Absolutely. And it's funny because to me, this actually speaks to even a wider argument or discussion on public policy in general. I think sometimes people think if you don't get everything you want the first time you go out for it, that it's just dead in the water from a governmental perspective. And in reality, it's extremely incremental. So even today, as we deal with our day-to-day non-bipartisan agreement on various topics, which we could pick anyone out of the air, it's all about incremental change when it comes to the government and government agencies, and telehealth and healthcare is no different.
That's right. That's right. As a senator from Louisiana, John Brew, used to say, it's better to have 50% of something than 100% of nothing. And politics, yep, the art of the compromise at the end of the day. And so it's about coming together and getting as good a deal as you can for your interests. And ours, obviously, is making sure Americans have access to telehealth technology.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As you mentioned, ATA brings together industry leading providers and vendors, and you have a big tent, and you're, working with all the different areas and folks that are working in the telehealth space, regardless of their perspective, and helping them to move policy forward and ultimately, as you mentioned, move healthcare forward, because telehealth is health, and ultimately that's moving healthcare in general for patients forward. What's sort of next here when we think about telehealth? This could be anything from AI, which we hear lots of horror stories sometimes on the news, and then we hear the great advantages of them. And it doesn't have to be just AI, but what's kind of next on your list and what you see next for telehealth?
Well, in a lot of ways, the list keeps growing. I mentioned earlier that the state level, we've had a lot of permanent policy changes favorable to telehealth, many times making permanent things that came about on a temporary basis during the pandemic. However, a lot more work to do in the state, at the state level, a lot more work to make sure that policies are truly modality neutral, that Medicaid coverage that's largely determined on a state-by-state basis robustly covers and reimburses for telehealth services, continuing the work of breaking down interstate barriers to care, making sure more compacts are being adopted and other licensure arrangements are being adopted. So the work will never go away there. It could be in the nature of a medical board or regulatory agency coming up with policies that are either positive or almost as concerning negative policies that hinder, again, the full potential of telehealth. So that work will continue. At the federal level, we've had a lot of advancements, but they've pretty much all been temporary. And so that's why we're really going to fight to make sure that Medicare beneficiaries don't go back to a pre-pandemic time when they had very limited access to telehealth technology, and that we continue to build on the momentum on a year-to-year basis, largely speaking, of the degree to which services like remote monitoring are offered. There's this big unknown about what's next for remote prescriptions of clinically appropriate controlled substances. We've had the ability for providers that have prescribing authority to deliver that care to patients during the last 3 years. We've been given a reprieve by the Drug Enforcement Administration that'll get us the status quo until November as they determine what the permanent framework will look like. We want to make sure we get that right and we balance safety with patient access and patient choice. And so that's really important. To your other great point as well, there are developments afoot that obviously have extraordinary implications for the telehealth community. We see state governments and to some degree the federal government beginning to get really interested in privacy generally and health data privacy in particular. Who gets access to what health data when? And how can that data be deployed ideally in the best interest of a patient's health? That's going to be a sticky wicket of issues that we're going to have to continue to deal with. We've seen a lot of state interest and, like I said, federal interest. And then, yeah, finally, AI is definitely the topic du jour this year. I bet just 6 months ago, most people did not have ChatGPT top of mind. Now it is. It's obviously we're seeing pretty extraordinary advancements in the use of AI. At the end of the day, just as we really say very clearly, telehealth is health. It's nothing separate and apart. The deployment and use of AI should be seen as yet another tool, but only that, a tool in the delivery of quality healthcare. So this idea that we're going to be licensing AI to deliver care, that we're going to replace the human element, that we're going to replace the licensed medical professional that has to make clinical judgments in the best interest of their patient. The idea that we'll do that is a fallacy and it's wrong. It's the wrong way to think about it. But what we should also do is make sure that we're deploying as effectively as possible this extraordinary new technology so that we can start making sense of the reams of data that our healthcare system generates. With connected devices, with wearables, with remote monitoring technology, with asynchronous care, we have just an unbelievable, unfathomable amount of data that we can begin to process. And in a really exciting way, if we get the right policy frameworks in place at the federal level and state level, we can begin deploying technologies like AI to make sense of that data, do preventative care better than ever, make sure that people live longer, healthier, more fulfilling lives. And so that's the exciting bit. And so we have to get the framework right, and we have to make sure that AI isn't seen as a replacement for that judgment of a licensed medical professional.
100% behind you. I think that thinking and talking about AI as a replacement for a provider is fallacy. I think that there's, we heard same things when it came to things like any innovative element that comes through with healthcare. Google Glass, that was going to actually revolutionize the way that we did surgeries. And, it's a tool. It's a tool that some use. It's a tool that some don't use. And it depends on their individual practice. And I think one thing that you brought up is really important around the access to data. I think, certainly from my perspective over the years and advocating for not only on the ATA side, but also with HIMSS, we've had privacy, patient identifier discussions. We've had, HIPAA discussions and how this data moves back and forth. But when you start to think about it in the nitty gritty, what about a clinical trial? can we take this information and have this be a clinical trial without an individual having to come back and forth, right? We can get a whole bunch of data and be able to pull that in as a secondary analysis to see whether or not a clinical trial for a particular drug or process would potentially work for patients. And without that access to information, it can be a little bit limiting. As always, Kyle, great discussion, thought-provoking. I'm already thinking about the next thing that that we can talk about, and we'll see you in not too distant future at the next ATA event. Thank you so much for being here. I want to make sure that people know where they can find more information from ATA and ATA Action. I have ATA Action, all one word, those two words together as one word, .org. Any other websites that you'd like to share that people can follow?
Also, our American Telemedicine Association website is americantelemed.org. And that's a great resource as well for your listeners. And thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, Michelle.
Absolutely. I always appreciate your time and sharing your information. Thank you so much for educating us on ATA, ATA Action, and the latest and greatest in telehealth. And it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Our next guest will be right up. Thank you for listening at tonight's show. This is Blue Cirrus Radio. We are the smartest show on radio.